Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, I head inside Forensic Science Ireland to see how developments in science and technology are transforming what they do. From the 1970s building block to the 2015 DNA database, we'll look at the evolution of the service. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or tweet with #TechTalkNT. So I jumped in a taxi from our studios here in Diggs Lane, Dublin 2, out to Garda headquarters in the Phoenix Park. At the back of the campus is an old office building that's home to the Forensic Science Labs for 40 years. I met with Chris Enright, the director of FSI, who told me more about what they do.
Okay, we're here in Forensic Science Ireland. We're based in a converted office building at the back of Garda headquarters. We've been here now for the best part of 30 years. And really the role of Forensic Science Ireland is to provide a comprehensive scientific analysis, independent expert opinion, advice and training on behalf of the criminal justice system. So we have approximately 126 people working here now. I say approximately because every week we're adding new staff to try and keep up with demand coming into the laboratory. We support a massive range of submissions into the laboratory. They range from murders, gangland shootings, sexual assaults, a vast array of illicit drug submissions, fibers, car crashes, assaults, you name it. We see it presenting in the lab in some way, shape or form over the course of a year. We had an excess of 16,500 submissions over the course of last year alone. And we reported on 13,000 different cases over the course of the year. That included drugs, murders, assaults. We also reported on 5 missing person cases over the course of the year. So those were cases that they range back actually from missing person reports over 33 years ago, where people went missing. In one particular case, a person was missing for over 33 years, were buried in an unmarked grave, and it's only last year that the body was exhumed and we were able to positively identify that person. So for those particular cases, as you'll see going through the lab, you'll get to understand some of the technology and the complexity behind it. But something like that is a very, very significant project. We've only been able to do that now on the basis of some breakthroughs in technology and our DNA database and some of our processes that the DNA team implemented over the course of the year. We have tried many times to achieve that same outcome and were unsuccessful. We were successful last year on the basis of the great work that the team has done here to really get those results. It's going to remain a significant focus for us. Mm-hmm. On top of the criminal cases that come into the lab, these missing person cases are really important to us, and we're going to try and do more and more over the next couple of years.
But in terms of the cases that you reported on in the last year alone, how does the process work in terms of cooperation with an Garda Síochána? When something happens, say if it's a murder, do your people go out to the scene, or are samples collected and brought to you? What way does that work?
Yeah, it really depends on the case. What happens is a senior investigating officer is assigned within an Garda Síochána, and they're responsible for the full investigation. For very serious crimes, including murders, we will often attend the scene at their request, and it's to impart specific expertise that could be around DNA evidence, DNA sampling, or blood pattern analysis, where we have very, very specific expertise, and we can bring that to the scene. It also helps in providing some continuity when it comes into the laboratory, that we can really understand more of where it came from. So, we attended over 20 scenes last year, and most of those were murder cases. We also attended some illicit drug labs. We attended a wide variety of situations. One was actually an active ingredient MDMA shop, We attended grow houses, we attended a tableting, illicit tableting facility to bring some technical expertise to the situation. Once it comes into the lab then, what we have to do is an evaluation on the basis of the context and the situation to really outline what is the course of the right course of analysis here that we should be doing on the basis of the key questions that present on the basis of the case context. So you really have to make a determination on what questions are you trying to answer and where can science help with that. On the basis of that analysis, we determine whether or not there's drugs analysis, DNA analysis, fiber analysis, glassware analysis. There's just a massive array of different scientific analysis techniques that we can do. It all depends on the context and the case. And then we report those findings verbally back to An Garda Síochána and the investigating officers. And then through a formal report that has evidential value when it comes to the court cases. We attended court on 96 occasions over the course of last year alone. And that attendance is a combination of outlining the report, explaining the context, and ultimately being also subject to cross-examination, where you can have a defence scientist that might challenge the findings, have a different view, and our scientists will have to defend the analysis, defend the approach, defend the methodology, and defend the findings associated with them.
You've touched upon a few different issues there, but in relation to the nature of crime, because we know that technology's infiltrated and impacted pretty much every industry, and have you seen a transformation in the types of tests you're able to do, the types of results you're able to give, and the methodology to ensure that the processes happen a bit faster? Has that happened over the last few years?
Yeah, there's been really several areas of innovation over the last number of years. The one that's most significant is DNA. So one is just the intelligence power of identification. There's a significant investment made in the DNA database. For example, last year alone, we added over 11,000 person profiles. We added close to 1,500 crime stains over the course of 2018 alone. So we're close to 5,500 crime stains on our national database at this point. And these are essentially samples that have been identified and collected at crime scenes. It could be a burglary, it could be a serious assault, but these are essentially stains that we get back, analyze in the lab, and we put on our national database. And then we can identify connections between suspects and those crime stains. We can also identify clusters or relationships between types of crime that happen around the country. So that it's a system level investment. There was a significant body of IT work that went in to support it, but the DNA technology or resolution of our DNA processes has also improved significantly over time. The work I mentioned earlier around missing persons was enabled on the basis of the DNA database, more refined DNA sequencing technology, and then much better DNA extraction techniques for decomposed bones that might be found in rivers and seas. So we can't stay still. There's no doubt about that. We need to be continuously pushing the science, our technology, and our services if we're going to keep up. Another example is drugs. There are new drugs being found all the time. The drugs market is continuously changing. We have to refine our analytical techniques and our processes to keep up with that. What we also need to do, we know that quicker and quicker analysis is often more useful. That's an area where we're going to invest in more to see if we can deliver on a faster service, a more rapid response for drugs identification. We think it's particularly important because of the intelligence value on the basis of potential health issues. We just don't have the staffing, the instrumentation, and the space at the minute to be able to keep up with everything that we want to do. So that all of those are areas that are enabled by more investment in staff, as well as more investment in new facilities.
I was going to ask, how are you guys funded? Does it come out of the Garda budget, or where does that money come from? And also, is there plans for expansion? Because as you mentioned, you know, you're constantly finding new ways, and obviously all of these devices and storage, even just you need space.
Yeah, so we're actually an office of the Department of Justice and Equality. So we're independent of An Garda Síochána. They're certainly one of our main customers. But the customer really in the broadest sense is the court systems, and providing a really solid and effective service to the courts and to the public more generally. So we have been able to kind of add staff over the last year or so, and we've been given an additional budget from the department to try and keep up with demand. At least move partially towards there over the course of this year. We're going to add 26 staff in 2019 alone. So that'll certainly help. The biggest gap that we have right now is our facility. It's a converted office. It's a 1970s building. It's not aging terribly well. And we know that it is a constraining factor for us in terms of being able to grow. In terms of being able to keep up with demand and being able to continuously improve the services that we offer. The good news is that we have made significant progress over the course of the year in designing a new building based in Backwest in County Kildare. So it's where the agricultural lab as well as the state lab are located. So the vision here is that we have a shared campus that supports delivering on scientific excellence across a range of different public services. The enabling works were completed last year, last April, and right now that's going through the procurement process, and we're hoping to have diggers out there in the second half of the year and really starting to work towards our new future. It's certainly very much needed at this point. It just can't come soon enough.
In terms of the samples that you collect and you test and, you know, that come to you, do you store them physically? You know, do you have a giant fridge with a million and one different samples?
Yeah, so we have, depending on the item, some items need storage, and we have multiple fridges and freezers. Not one massive one. They tend to be located closer to where the actual service and the analysis work is being done. Some items don't need storage, and we have larger storage areas for where climate control isn't as critical. So they're stored as they come into the laboratory. Sometimes they're stored in between different analysis types, and then they go back when the work is completed. They go back to the possession of An Garda Síochána. What we do is we've an electronic system that allows us to maintain continuity of evidence across the laboratory, no matter where it is. So we know whose possession is it in, what location is it in, when has it been received from An Garda Síochána, when does it go back to An Garda Síochána. So that's supported by an electronic tagging system that we have in place.
And, you know, some people are very open to the notion of having the DNA database. And I know we're going to talk about DNA in a few minutes' time.
Yeah.
But in terms of privacy and so on, do you have the right to store and scan through that information at any given time? You know, there's no sort of limitation on terms of, you know, you can only hold it for 12 months or 18 months or anything like that.
Our legislation on the DNA database is probably one of the most recent in Europe, and it was formulated based on a balanced view of data protection, privacy rights, human rights, as well as how do we make it a useful tool from an intelligence point of view. So there's a DNA Database Act that was put in place that really governs how long you can keep the sample while the investigation is progressing, for what purposes you can keep it, and when the sample needs to be destroyed or the profile needs to be destroyed. So it's extremely well outlined and documented what we're supposed to what we're supposed to do. There's also governance structures in place to make sure we're doing that. Mm-hmm. There's an independent DNA oversight committee that we report to on a frequent basis. What we share is how we're going about managing our process, how we're going about receiving samples, putting them on the database, reviewing them, deleting them. We have to report on a quarterly basis and respond accordingly as any questions come in. So there's very strong oversight on how we manage the database.
Obviously what you do is scientific, so there's no real sort of room for grey area. However, I've looked at and met people working in medicine and, you know, in an Garda Síochána, and they talk about the use of artificial intelligence and how they can deploy that to maybe fill in some gaps or look at probability of something happening again. Is that something that's used here in your labs?
Not right now. So right now Forensic Science Ireland doesn't have doesn't do digital forensics. It's something that we may do in the future at some point in time. But we use analytical tools and software that have a very significant amount of validation so that they can stand the test of evidential value in court. So we certainly use software tools to help us compare DNA profiles, deconvolute DNA profiles, compare reference to a case sample. All of that we do, but everything here has to stand the test of very, very robust validation, cross-examination, that there can be no doubt that this, the conclusions we're making are robust.
So I told a few people that I was coming out here, and now that we've had the intelligent conversation, I can ask the stupid question that everybody asked me to ask. Is it really like CSI Miami?
It's certainly, there's more substance, probably less style, and we would certainly love to have some of the facilities that you'd see on the CSI shows, that's for sure.
Coming up next, the Director of DNA.
Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. This week we're in the labs of Forensic Science Ireland. I sat down with Geraldine O'Donnell, the Director of DNA at FSI, who told me how samples are collected and tested.
There's DNA samples that are taken from people, and those samples are typically swabs that are taken from the inside mouth of the person. And they are obviously submitted for analysis. But then there's the other side, are the samples that are taken from crime scenes. And they can range from blood to semen to saliva. And then for the other, you know, areas outside of DNA, fibers and glass and paint and so on. So there's two sides to evidence collection. And then when they come into FSI, the two sides come together. Specifically in relation to DNA, when we get the person sample, we obviously extract their DNA profile. And similarly, we do it the similar process for the crime stains, and then we do a comparison. And if they match, then we declare there's a match. If there's an exclusion, we declare that. And for reporting purposes and for going to court, we obviously have to give an opinion as to how rare or how common that DNA profile is, so that the jury can put it into context. And typically the rarity of most profiles is greater than 1 in 1,000,000. So we're talking about very discriminating levels.
Okay. And so when you collect a sample or a sample is brought to you, let's just talk about blood, for example. How long does the process take to build up or to extract the DNA and then to make some form of a call on it?
It can be done relatively quickly. A good fresh blood sample, a DNA profile can be generated pretty much in a day. With other cases coming into the lab, obviously everything has to be prioritised. But, you know, in broad terms, that's the length of time. There's several steps. You have to obviously extract the DNA. And that's just basically opening up the cell type, the blood cells, and releasing the DNA. And then you have to find out actually how much you have, you know, quantify it. And once you do that, then you then link certain what we call fluorescent targets, because we don't go in and look at every part of the DNA. We target 17 different areas, and one of those is the sex-linked area, and that tells whether the crime stain is male or female. And other than that, you can't tell anything about the DNA profile. And the last stage then is actually generating the DNA profile with the fluorescent tags attached to them. And the final result is just a numerical set of numbers for a person's DNA profile over the 17 different areas. And at that stage then, going back to your original question, that's when you do the comparison to see, does the person sample have the same 17 areas as your crime stain, and you declare your result at that stage.
It's so interesting. How difficult is it to run these types of tests on older samples? So you mentioned there if it was fresh blood, but we heard earlier on just about some of the cold cases and the missing person cases that can benefit from this type of science. But how much harder is the process?
It depends on the evidence type. The technology has become so sensitive in recent times that even for old blood stains and old semen stains, we will get DNA profiles. There is an overriding factor that the blood stains and semen stains need to have been kept in a good environment. If they're exposed to too much heat or poor environmental conditions, obviously the DNA will just keep breaking down and breaking down, and at some point it can be reached that we can't actually get a DNA profile from it. But that would be really unusual. Mm-hmm. Where we have struggled in the past, and indeed international colleagues have struggled as well, is to actually get DNA from old remains, body remains. Mm-hmm. And we've had obviously very, good success throughout 2018 in particular. In this regard, where we went back and kept refining our extraction method to get DNA from the bones, and we were able to identify five different bodies in 2018. There was Angus Gussie Shanahan, whose body was found remains were found in 2001. Then there was Margaret Glennon, whose remains were found in 2014. And we had James Gallagher, whose remains were found around 2002. And then we also helped internationally when two bodies were exhumed, one in France and one in the UK. And We're continually working on old bone cases. We have ourselves about 20 of those cases currently in the lab. And at this stage, we have gone through 10 of them. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to link them to anybody. That is driven by the fact that we need the relative samples or samples from the relatives so that we can put them actually into the DNA database. So that when we generate a DNA profile from the bone, that there's relative samples that can be compared directly. So
if somebody has a relative, or if there's somebody in their lives that they feel is missing or something may have happened to them, if they come forward and offer a DNA sample for it to be lodged in your system, then it can be cross-referenced against some of these bodies that you've mentioned.
Yes, that's true. We would have over 300 odd samples taken from relatives at this point in time sitting on the national database. That those samples would have come from roughly around 120 families. And we do very actively try at functions such as the International Missing Persons Day or our National Missing Persons Day to encourage families to actually give samples. And we set up together with the Garda Missing Persons Bureau, we set up a stand and we take the samples on the day. So we really do try, and it's an important message, and if something like this helps to increase it, it's such a positive thing, because it's you know, we do the work, and it would be lovely then if we could actually get it to the final juncture of where it's actually, we can actually put a person's name to it.
Yeah, and get some answers to those questions. You mentioned at the beginning, but just explain, if someone does come forward, what's involved in the DNA extraction process? Is it just a swab of the cheek?
Oh, yes. Very similar to what you would have given us today, mm-hmm. When you came in. It literally is like putting a big cotton swab into your mouth and just getting DNA that's present in your mouth, and it's just that simple, and that's enough to give us your DNA sample. There's nothing invasive about it at all.
And then those samples are stored onto the DNA database. Explain to me how much of a body of work it was to get this off the ground and to build it up to where we are now.
Yes, the DNA database, the law that governs the DNA database was enacted in 2014, and the DNA database was established in November 2015. So we're looking at about 3.5 years at this stage of its operation. And it really has gone from strength to strength. I mean, very simply, for your listeners, the DNA database is like a large repository of DNA profiles. These are of two types. There's those from the persons and those from crime stains that we haven't been able to determine the origin. So if today a burglary comes into FSI and we generate an unknown DNA profile, we put it up against the DNA database to see if it matches any persons that are in the database or indeed any unknown crime stains. So Since its enactment, its first full year of operation would have been 2016. At the end of that year, we would have had a crime-solving capability of about 23%, meaning that every, you know, in 23 out of 100 of every unknown crime stains that went onto the DNA database, there was a person there to match. And then at the end of 2017, that had gone up to around 34%. And at the end of this year, it's pretty much close to 40%. So that's 2 in 5 of every unknown crime stain that goes up onto the database. There's a person there to match. So it's really great intelligence information. And as I said, that's there's two parts to the database. That's the crime part, and then we have the missing persons part, and that's where all the samples from missing people or unknown people, their profiles are put up. And again, we have the same capabilities that when relative samples come in, we can check to see whether any of the bodies and relatives match. And, you know, it's an ongoing process and proven very successful.
And I assume that the more samples you have, you know, the higher that number will go, because you'll be able to crack down on things. Do you think that, you know, would you be open to people just giving their DNA, like willingly handing over their DNA? Or do you think that you don't want to be overwhelmed, so it's better that it comes on a case by case basis? So in the instance of the family member of a missing person or a crime scene or whatever it may be.
Well, I suppose that argument has been had, you know, as far back as 2003, when the Law Reform Commission was brought together to actually decide, is the DNA database going to hold everybody's DNA sample, or is it going to be selected based on people being suspected of serious offences which carry a prison sentence of around 5 years? The decision was made to go with not sampling everybody. I think that's appropriate. Not that I personally feel that there's anything you know, negative against a whole population database, but I think it, even based on our crime solving capabilities, it's up at 40%. So targeting of people is actually probably a more rational approach, mm-hmm. Targeting in the sense of, you know, people that are suspected of crime, not in any other sense, you know. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And in terms of, you know, anyone who's watching Line of Duty at the moment will all be aware of contamination of DNA samples. How frequent... So firstly, how does that happen, both on a crime scene and then does it happen in a lab? And once a sample has been contaminated, is it then completely disregarded?
Yes, well, contamination is a term that I suppose can be overused as well. I mean, there's always a natural contamination of a crime scene sample because it's landing on something that has been exposed, mm-hmm. to people touching it and therefore there'll be DNA and that. When it comes into the laboratory, certainly we introduce a whole suite of methods to reduce the possibility of contamination. People gown up, wear face masks and head mops, and you know, all the areas are cleaned down. We also take, you know, a range of what we call environmental controls so that we know if there's any contamination in our background. Mm-hmm. You can never minimize, you can never say that you're never going to have any DNA. I mean, DNA is ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. Similarly with ourselves, that's, and indeed with yourself having to give a sample today when you came to FSI, we have to make sure that none of your DNA has been left. And once we generate a DNA profile, we check against all our staff and all our visitors so that we're confident that when we're reporting a DNA profile that it's related to the case and not related to any other aspect.
And again, so I'm here in your office and I've had the palm of my hand on your desk. Can you take anything from that when I leave the room? I mean, or are these all sort of Hollywood notions of how forensics works?
No. I think the reality, and I mentioned it earlier, the DNA technologies have got very sensitive. I would be in the lab now over 27 years, still look relatively fresh, I hope. I have seen huge changes. I mean, my first DNA case was I performed in 1994-95, and in those days you needed DNA or a blood stain that would have been the size of a 20-cent coin. But now the reality is you don't actually have to see the DNA. So you touching the desk or indeed drinking a glass of water and leaving it behind would give a very good source of DNA so that we could generate a DNA profile. So yes, that is the reality. You don't have to see it.
Mm. And where are we going in terms of the technology? Like, are we going to get to a stage whereby your team could have like a mobile DNA processing unit that they can bring to crime scene so that the process is kind of sped up that bit more? Or will samples always have to come to a lab?
No. There's particularly in the USA, there's what they call rapid DNA machines that can be taken in the back of a lorry, mm-hmm. Or a van, and they can be taken to a scene, and a blood swab taken can be put through this machine, and a DNA profile generated. The DNA profile would still have to come to the lab, you know, if it was to be checked against the national database and so on. And indeed, we actually trialled one of those machines last year ourselves here, but we found the sensitivity wasn't great for, it was good for really fresh DNA, mm-hmm. but not for slightly older DNA. So we're keeping a very close eye on that technology. And it is possible, yes.
I said earlier on in the conversation that, you know, what you guys do is so scientific. How much of what's presented in court from SFI or from FSI is opinion based? Or, you know, can you interpret something that is black and white on a computer screen or on a piece of paper and give opinion of, like, we think that this person did X, Y, and Z? Or can you only report on your findings?
In answer to that question, the role of the expert or the DNA scientist is to go to court and give the DNA evidence, but make sure it's not given in a misleading way. And by that I mean, if you took even a simple burglary case and you're going to court and you're saying that this DNA profile matches Mr. Smith, and you give a figure of how rare that profile is in the population, you need to be very careful that you understand the background information in relation to that burglary, because if it turns out that Mr. Smith actually had legitimate access to that site, then it would be very remiss of me as a DNA scientist to go to court and give this big figure, and that's what the jury is hearing, but then they're not hearing that actually this person had legitimate access. So from that point of view, we have to be really careful to interpret the DNA findings, because by themselves, they're very powerful, very probative. We need to make sure that they are being heard and understood correctly by the jury. I mean, another very good example of that, Jess, would be, you know, a sexual assault case, and say this the victim is saying she was allegedly raped on a particular night, and the suspect, when questioned, said, "Well, no, nothing happened on that particular night, but we had consensual sex two nights before." DNA scientists would have to be really careful there, because finding semen or finding a DNA profile from the semen wouldn't help the jury determine whether it was two nights before or whether it was the night in question, because you would get the DNA profile anyway. And that's where you could be extremely misleading by giving the big figure, because the jury, once they hear the DNA, would actually think, okay, you know, it happened on the night in question. The important thing there is the amount of semen that was found, because you would expect quite large amount of semen if it was the night in question versus two nights before, where the semen would be degrading and you would get much less. So you can see there's a complexity there. It's not just a matter of just, and that's the same for all the other disciplines, be it chemistry in particular as well. I mean, if you find glass in a burglary, or, you know, there's no point going and telling the jury, "I found lots of glass," because there could be other explanations for that. They, you know, they could have just been walking past it.
In court, when somebody like yourself is presenting what they find or what they found, and you're cross-examined, how does that work? Because surely you are just talking about facts. Is it your interpretation, your methodology? What does get questioned?
Well, you're there as an expert witness, and your area of expertise is DNA. So from that point of view, and it has happened to myself on numerous occasions, you get questioned from everything, from what is DNA, how you get your profile, how, you know, the different steps, and it can be done in you know, sometimes very detailed ways, where you have to explain physically every single step that you went through. And then you give your evidence and what you consider the significance of your evidence and your interpretation, and then the defence will obviously question you as to ensure the validity of what you're saying. And often we have defence scientists that come in to FSI ahead of the scientist going to court, so they get a chance to revisit the case and obviously generate any questions that they think there may be gaps with, and so on.
And finally then, just in terms of technology, because we are a tech show, do you envisage much change or advancement in what you do and how you do it with new technological advancements?
Well, Jess, we haven't stopped doing technological advances in DNA. We've gone through at least five different types of DNA chemistries to generate DNA profiles. You know, we had kits where we looked at six areas, and then others that we looked at 11 areas, and then we looked now at 17. But in addition to having a DNA kit that looks at 17 areas, we've also introduced a kit that looks specifically at the Y DNA, the male DNA. This has been particularly useful for sexual assaults and also for body identifications involving the male line. We have fully automated her processes for getting DNA from the person samples, and we've also fully automated our line for getting crime scenes DNA from crime scene samples. Everything to do with looking at the profiles and analysing it is all software and IT based. And even last year, and we got a Civil Service Excellence Innovation Award, we brought in a new type of interpretation software where we can actually look and interpret complex mixture profiles from DNA samples. And this goes back to the earlier point, Jess, that I was making, that DNA has got very sensitive. Mm-hmm. So you're not just getting a lovely single profile. You know, in an armed robbery, for instance, and if it's a discarded balaclava, you could have up to three profiles. And that's been a really good development, that we can do a lot more with the DNA profiles with respect to interpretation. So we're even now looking at the next generation of profiling, which is where we will start in time looking at the whole sequence.
Wow.
So we can't afford to stand still, and also we're going in now to the whole area of what's called PRUM. It's where we actually start automatically exchanging all our data information with our other European countries. So we were successfully evaluated to do that in 2018, just the year gone, and we'll be starting now exchanging information in the next few weeks, actually, with
wow.
member states.
That's exciting. So what do you anticipate will come from that, and what will be the benefits?
Well, the benefits, I mean, the whole ethos behind PRUM is that it's to help to combat cross-border terrorism and crime. And again, because we didn't have the database until more recent times, other countries are up and running with this and actually exchanging information and actually solving crime from actually exchanging databases with each other.
Wow.
Yeah. And there was a lovely case, actually, and it's the one that sticks out in my mind because in some ways it's priceless. There was an exchange of DNA information between Germany and the Netherlands. It was found, there was a DNA profile found on a blanket that had been taken from an abandoned baby. And it was found that there was a profile in the German database taken from a blanket, and it matched actually another blanket taken from another abandoned baby in the Netherlands. And it turned out to be same mother that had abandoned the
wow.
children, and they were able to obviously get the mother's DNA profile from the blankets. And in those countries, obviously, abandoning a child is a criminal offence, so that's why they were included in the database for actually exchange, and for two siblings to be reunited. As you know, that's priceless.
The title of it is just incredible.
Yes, and that's a a human story. But I mean, that there's been murders and terrorist mm-hmm. cases solved as a result of exchanging data.
That was Geraldine O'Donnell. Now, I gave a sample of my DNA to Geraldine. It was a pain-free process. I simply wiped a sterilised swab against my cheek. She rubbed it off a pink piece of paper that turned white to indicate that there was DNA there. And coming up next, we'll hear what happens to those samples.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
Welcome back to Tech Talk. Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. This week we're in the labs of Forensic Science Ireland. Geraldine O'Donnell, the Director of DNA at FSI, took me on a tour of the facility to show me what happens to the samples once collected.
So the profile that you gave me a few minutes ago, this is where it eventually will end up in. And in this room here on the right, this is where we actually take the little punches from your card and we put the little fluorescent markers onto it so that we can then look at your 17 different areas. And then at that stage, we bring it across to this laboratory here, where it's actually put on the sequencing machines, and you can see there's two of those against the back wall, and we have an automated machine for the setup of the plates, and the profile is generated in here and then it's sent to another room for analysis.
Okay. And this might be a stupid question, but why are there so many individual labs?
Well, there needs to be so many individual labs, Jess, because everything about forensic science is keeping both sides of the case separate. And that primarily is because of the possibility of contamination. Mm-hmm. And here we have everything to do with the people samples. And as we walk through, you'll see we have everything to do with the crime. And even within the crime scene aspect, if there's an assault, for instance, and you have a victim and a few suspects, all their clothing has to be kept separate and all the evidence recovered in separate ways. So that's why you will see small rooms and contained rooms. And here, in this room here, Jess, is where we actually operate the DNA National Database. A small room.
It's very small.
Yes, it's this is a constraint that we do have in this building. Because it's offices, you have to work within the confines of conversions. And this will be one of the big benefits when we get to our new building in Back West, and that we will have more space. But what happens here is all the person's profiles that are generated, as you saw walking through, end up in the national database here. And then all the DNA profiles that are generated in the crime scene area that are unknown, they also come back to this point. And the comparison is done by our database team. And then the matches then are communicated to the scientists, who then communicate them onwards to the cards.
I had a notion of a huge, big, facility where it was like almost a physical database.
What I'm
looking at now is two small desks with four monitors.
There's one, two, three. Yeah, there's four desks with monitors. The actual database software is an FBI product. And they have generated this and they trained us in it. So it's always going to be heavily IT based. So in some ways, all you need are computers and everything then feeds into it. But I do agree with you, it's a cozy room.
It's just not what I was expecting. Thank you. In terms of the people that you have working here.
Yes.
What's their backgrounds? Are they all DNA scientists, or what type of people work here?
The type of people that work here are all scientists. They all have a minimum of a level 8 qualification, either in chemistry or biochemistry, microbiology, depending on where they're going to be in the lab. The reality is that most people, in fact, all people either have a master's or a PhD. And we have two working grades, if you like. We have our analysts, and then we have our scientists. And now here actually is a search room that has actually a set of clothing that will be looked at for blood pattern analysis. And that's another area of particular use for court-going purposes. And here, for instance, the allegation is that the suspect kicked the person. And sometimes the alternative that is put forward is that, no, I wasn't involved in the kicking, but, you know, I walked through the pool of water, okay, or a pool of blood in this instance. And through looking at that pattern, we can determine actually whether it was due to the suspect kicking the person.
Because there is a big blotch of blood down on the right, the bottom of the right leg, but then there are little dots. It kind of looks like, you know, when you get a paintbrush and you throw it against the wall, the little splatters.
Exactly. And you have a typical pattern, and that's why it's really important to get both the shoes, obviously, of the suspect, but also the trousers. Mm-hmm. And typically also with BPA, and again, this is the point you were making earlier, we were talking about earlier, Jess, about interpretation, because for BPA, often the scenario will be that I wasn't actually involved, I just was standing nearby.
Okay.
And in that instance, if a DNA scientist actually looks and they find what's called a contact stain, then that pushes the evidence much more in favour of the person actually being involved in the incident as against actually standing by.
Okay.
So it's a very rich information type. But again, you need a lot of experience in actually interpreting blood patterns to make sure that you know what you're saying is actually valid.
Mm-hmm.
And very useful, you know. And sometimes it can be that the defence is that I was actually cradling the person rather than being involved. So often then the pattern is really important to look at from that point of view as well, to see does that actually add up.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, typically some scenes that we're called out to, we're not called out to every scene, but there's scenes, particularly the whodunit, but also where did it start can be another important aspect. You know, because you'll find blood maybe upstairs and coming down the stairs and in bedroom or, you know, sitting room, mm-hmm, floors and whatever. And the question then can be, well, actually, where did this assault happen?
Wow.
And very much a BPA can help in that regard, because it can tell where the impact occurred. So, yeah, very, very useful. But everything, Jess, is time-consuming as well.
I can imagine.
You know, so you know, we have you know, like any work in laboratory, we have a high demand for our services. So we endeavour to prioritise them in the best way we can.
It is hard to imagine that in instances of sexual assault or murder, that samples are coming in here for you guys to determine what exactly happened.
Yeah, it's something, I suppose, in one way you do get used to. It's your job. But that said, there are times, even on a personal level, I would feel more affected by certain cases than others. Say,
mm-hmm,
they, you know, particularly a more recent one that would have affected me would have been the death of the 15-year-old girl last summer, Anna Kriegel.
Mm-hmm.
I think because she was 15, and I have one of my young daughters is the same age, and I could identify with somebody calling at the house and her going out,
mm-hmm,
and I just find that very difficult. But that's a case, actually, now that I mention it, that DNA was particularly useful in from an investigative point of view, because it helped actually at the front end, it helped the guards greatly. You know, DNA can be great, it's not great all the time. Sometimes it just corroborates, and sometimes it can't help at all. But there's times where it actually does help very much with the investigation. last summer was actually a bad enough summer, you know, with the death of the young boy as well in Dunleer.
Yeah.
And that was another case where DNA happened to be good for the investigation and help target it. Yeah, you do get used to it, Jess, in one way, but, you know.
You probably can't dwell too much on what you're doing and why you're doing it, because you probably just wouldn't come in on Monday.
Yeah, exactly. You just have to, yes, case by case.
That was Geraldine O'Donnell, Director of DNA at FSI. And my thanks to the team at Forensic Science Ireland for letting me into the labs, but also for giving me their time. And that is all we have time for this week, unfortunately. If you missed any of the programme, you can listen back up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcast from, as you will find some extra bits and pieces hidden in there. Patrick Gagan is up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.